You guys ready? Let's answer these objections, and then we will take a few questions, but just a few. And sometimes I will tell you I don't know also, because I don't know everything. Don't tell my kids that. All right. So these are the arguments that people make to justify legalizing abortion. And by the way, if I missed any of your favorites, feel free to ask me about them and we will address them later. But let's go ahead and take a look at these. The first one is this argument that pregnancy can be a threat to the mother's life and that pro-life people want to keep women in dangerous circumstances. The fact of the matter is, not true. Remember what we talked about earlier? I said how our opponents, they want to conflate the whole idea of all abortions altogether. This is an example of that. Remember how I defined abortion for you. Abortion is an act of violence that intentionally takes the life of an unborn child. So, are women at risk post-Roe? Right? In the Dobbs era, are women at risk from pregnancies that actually could kill them? For example, an ectopic pregnancy. Ladies and gentlemen, if a woman has an ectopic pregnancy, which the vast majority of the time occurs inside of her fallopian tube, I'm telling you, most women, if they had an ectopic pregnancy and the medical technology were available to do it, they would take that embryo out of her fallopian tube and implant it in her uterus. As things stand right now, that is not possible to do. So the gold standard of care for ectopic pregnancy is to go in surgically, put a couple of clamps on the fallopian tube, clip it, and take the fallopian tube out with the child. Sometimes they inject a drug called methotrexate, but the gold standard is what I just described. I want you to note something. The intention of the surgery is not to end the life of that child. The intention of the surgery is to save the life of the woman, because if you allow the pregnancy to continue, that child is going to die, and the mother is very likely to die. So the physician's job then is to maximize the availability of life, and so they remove the child. The death of the child is foreseen. The death of the child is not intended. And I have news for you, folks. There are plenty of examples where continuing a pregnancy really does put the life of a woman at risk. And sometimes the women say, if I've got a shot at delivering a healthy baby at the end of this, I will gladly risk my life. Things like when women have cancer and they're needing invasive chemotherapy or something. Some women, they back off and say, no, I want to let my child gestate as long as possible. Maybe they deliver the child with a C-section, and God willing, both of them live. But it is not unknown for some women to actually have sacrificed their lives for their children. In the case of an ectopic pregnancy, that is not an option. Right? That woman is 99.99999% of the time going to die if it continues. There is not a single state that forbids physicians from treating women with life-threatening pregnancies. And if anybody throws up that Facebook meme to you and says, oh yeah, well no, look, it's putting women's lives at risk. Say, tell you what, I'll make you a deal. You go out, Google it, search all you want. Find a single physician who post-Dobbs has been convicted of treating a woman with an ectopic pregnancy. And then we can talk. Oh, but you don't understand, but the physicians are afraid. You know who the afraid physicians are? Abortionists. And they're using these kinds of memes to scare you into thinking that all doctors are, you know, suffering from this inconclusive fear. And by the way, some state governments are working overtime to make sure that the law is ridiculously clear on what is and is not allowed. So, it's important to understand, treatment of an ectopic pregnancy does not fit my definition of an abortion, because it does not intentionally take the life of an unborn child. It doesn't fit elective abortion. Number two, my body, my choice. Already told you, the bumper sticker argument is easy to defeat, because I think I've made it really, really clear, in case you didn't figure it out yet. It's not the woman's body. It's a person's body who happens to currently reside inside of a woman's body, but it is not her body. How do I know it's not her body? Well, there's lots of interesting tells. One of them, of course, is that it makes things rather odd if a woman is pregnant and she is carrying a man-child, how you would describe her various body parts. In California, might fly. Out here, probably not so much so. So, it's not her body. It's a separate body. Could have a separate blood type. By the way, if there wasn't a blood barrier in there, it could literally put the woman's life at risk because they're varying blood types. It's not the woman's DNA. I mean, there's all kinds of variables. It's not a hard argument to make. Also, I'm going to demonstrate to you that you are not allowed to do, although people love to say this, whatever you want with your own body. Ladies, how many of you have been pregnant and have had difficult pregnancies, by which I mean you threw up a lot? Okay. Now, ladies, what if I told you, out in my car, I've got a drug, and it works, and if you will take it, next time you're pregnant, you'll have almost no morning sickness at all. Interested? Would you like it? You know what? The drug exists, but no doctor will give it to you. Isn't that? But wait a minute. It's my body, my choice. Right? But they won't give it to you because that drug is called thalidomide. And while thalidomide was very, very good at suppressing nausea, it also created horrific fetal abnormalities. So it doesn't hurt your body, it hurts somebody else's body, and every physician knows it. So this simple version of my body, my choice, is fairly easy to dismiss. Judith Jarvis Thompson's violinist analogy, though, is tougher. And by the way, most of the people I know who are pro-abort, this is what they go to. It's this kind of analogy that they go to. Nobody has the right to use someone else's body, is what they're saying. And when you think about it, like on a baseline, it seems reasonable. But whenever people argue from analogy, it's very important that you break that analogy down and make sure that the fit between the analogy and the thing being analogized to are very similar. So let's take a look and see. First of all, the relationship. You have been kidnapped and you will find yourself artificially connected to a violinist. Who is that violinist to you? Nobody. Complete and utter stranger. You do not have the same kind of obligations toward total strangers that you have to your own kids. So in Judith Jarvis Thompson's example, the person you're hooked up to is a stranger, but in pregnancy, you are a parent. Parents have obligations to their children. And by the way, if you're willing to stand up and argue that parents don't have to use their bodies to support their children, there are millions of men paying child support right now that would love to get right on board with you about that. Aren't they using their body to support somebody else? There are people who are making that argument. Secondly, the method. Isn't it wild how she talks about, well, you just get unplugged. Doesn't that sound antiseptic? Kind of simple thing. You walk over and just unplug yourself. Now, I want you to imagine if the same scenario was pitched to the guy, except for instead of using this antiseptic technological term, they made it look a little more like an actual abortion. Imagine what would happen if the person's, because keep in mind, when you get unplugged from the violinist, you didn't do anything to kill the violinist. You've unplugged yourself. The violinist is just going to die of his own pathology. But in abortion, what happens is it would be like saying, okay, yeah, we can unplug you from the violinist, but first we have to bring in a guy with a chainsaw. He's going to start by the guy's feet, his arms, his legs. We get down to his torso, then we'll finally be able to safely unplug you. I think that would suddenly terrifically alter your perception about being unplugged. But the fact of the matter is, in this analogy, right, you aren't responsible for what happens to the violinist. He's going to die of his own pathology. In this case, the method of abortion is a violent method. Number three, it overstates the hardship. It tries to make it look like if you're pregnant, you're imprisoned. Right? That's what she's trying to say. It's like being pregnant. You're imprisoned for 9 months. Well, my wife was pregnant with our eldest son, and she worked all the way up until she thought she was due. Right? Matter of fact, I know a lot of women who say, man, they're a lot easier to take care of inside than outside, frankly. Right? Right? Food, nutrition, hydration, waste removal services, all automated. Right, earlier than later, it's all manual. Women go about their lives. My wife says the only time she's ever really been warm her entire life was when she was pregnant. You know, got an internal heater thing going on. Also, this idea of imprisonment, right? That's why they keep talking about terminating the pregnancy, right? That's a euphemism people use for abortion. I got news for you. All pregnancies terminate. And aren't you glad? Yeah, I got to tell you, we were told that. My son decided to be about nearly 3 weeks late. Yeah, finally got down by my wife's abdomen, and I said, if you don't come out, we're coming in after you. And it's really funny. The next that night, my wife's water broke. Okay. See, I am persuasive. So, but right, it overstates this hardship. The hardship's not nearly what they're describing here. And then number four, the burdens. Judith Jarvis Thompson is making the argument that if you will unplug yourself from the violinist, you will shed the burden of the violinist. But in an abortion, you don't shed a burden, you trade burdens. See, on the one hand, you have the burden of being pregnant and bearing offspring. And you know, there is a kind of burden that goes along with that. But in an abortion, you don't shed that burden. In an abortion, you trade the burden. It was the burden of a child, and now it's the burden of knowing that you have conspired together with at least one or two other people to purposefully end the life of another human being. And Chris Kaser says, for some people, that burden is never relieved, ever. I'm here to tell you that if that is your story, right, we have post-abortion counseling that can help you find your way toward forgiveness and healing. And you can talk to Linda. Linda, raise your hand. You can talk to Linda at some point in time. Anybody else here from the center? Linda, is there anybody else here from? No? Okay. Or you can come up and talk to me, and I'll put you on to Linda and her group. And by the way, that's not just for women. There are a lot of men walking around with a tremendous amount of pain and anguish as a result of a past abortion. And we want you to find forgiveness and healing. I want to take a brief insert here about the term. How many of you guys have seen a meme that says, you're not pro-life, you're just forced birth? You guys heard that? Anybody heard that? Yeah, it comes around all the time. Okay. My friend Andrew Harris is one of my former graduate students at Regent. He now teaches at Cedarville University. He came running into the Defending Life Summer Institute and said, I got a great thing. Here, let me share this with you. And so I told him for at least the first year I'd give him credit for this argument. Later, it'll just all absorb it and it'll just become another one of mine probably. But, you know. Scholars, at first you cite, and afterwards you just look smarter. I will try to always, see this being filmed. Andrew, I will always, always credit you for this. So this is what he said. He said, they've got it entirely backwards. So I want you to think about what the term birth means. So if a guy's a genius and they say, he gave birth to an idea, what does it mean? It means he had an idea in his head, and then he birthed it out into the world. Maybe created a business, created a product, right? When we birth a child, the child's on the inside, and then the child comes out on the outside. Now, nobody in the pro-life field that I know of is trying to force that birth. As a matter of fact, we kind of like you to wait and let it happen naturally, about 38 to 40 weeks. The only people in this scenario that are engaging in forced birth are abortionists, because they're the ones who go in and forcibly take the child from the inside to the outside, unfortunately, in pieces, but they are the ones engaging in forced birth. And so the next time you see that on social media, go after it, because that is a libel that's horrifying. Nobody's here for, folks, pregnancy, I got news for you. When a man and woman really love each other, it's a natural thing. Men and women, their bodies come together, and sometimes children are created. It's natural. It's how God created our biology. It's normal. Children are not tumors, right? Pregnancy is not a disease. It's just a normal, natural thing. Because I got news for you. It's the only way any of you got here. And yet, isn't it odd that we live in a culture where some of us who already have the privilege of being here want to say to other people, not you. You don't get that. These next ones we're going to just kind of handle collectively. The threat to the mother's physical health, right? Difficult pregnancies, by the way, they can be monitored. Difficult pregnancies, children can be delivered early via C-section. For example, if you have placenta previa, your children can be just delivered early. Same thing for gestational diabetes, hypertension. The threat to the psychological well-being of the mother, right? The threat to the economic well-being of the mother. All of these arguments, they all assume, they don't prove, they assume the unborn aren't human. Now, how do we know that they assume it and don't prove it? See, if we have already demonstrated that that there's no morally significant difference, right, between the embryo you used to be and the human being that you are now that would have made it justifiable to kill you then but not now, right, if that's what we believe, then you may substitute any human being for the child in the womb. So look at the arguments. If your six-year-old gets you sick a lot, would you be allowed to put them to death? No. If there's no morally significant difference between those two human beings, then you shouldn't be able to do it to that one either. And by the way, just to clarify, I was never more sick in my life than when I had toddlers. Right? Amen. Right? Because what are the kid's got snot running down his face, he's got his hands and God only knows what, you know, walking up, waddling up to you, Dad! You know, what do? You hit him with a fire hose before you pick him up? You know, no. You just pick him up. He gets sick sometimes. By the way, college students aren't much better. I got to tell you, man, I always grab the door handle to my classroom like this, right? Never know where those kids have been. Just because women, some of them have, by the way, I'm going to call them Linda. When women come to the clinic and they find out and are surprised by the fact that they have an untimely pregnancy, do those women ever cry and get upset? Like ever? Yeah, like always, right? All the time. They're very unhappy, right? Now, some women, once they have babies, they become very unhappy. It's called postpartum depression. Sometimes it can be very deep. So, should we just relieve her depression by killing her newborn? No. And, you know, some people get very depressed because their kids kind of fall off the wagon, they go down the wrong path, whatever, and they make life at home very difficult. The Proverbs are filled with kids who do that to their parents. Doesn't say anywhere in there that you can put those kids to death. Right? Well, if there's no morally significant difference between the two, when people argue that because of economic circumstances, psychological circumstances, health circumstances, that these are justifications for putting children to death, putting unborn children to death, if you can't put born children to death for those reasons, you shouldn't be able to put unborn children to death. And I'm going to show you an article that was published in a major medical journal that literally argues the flip of that. And they say, because we could kill you in the womb, we should be able to kill you now. I'll show that to you here in a little bit. The social stigma that attaches to unwed motherhood, by the way, not nearly as significant as it used to be. Out-of-wedlock births are unfortunately very common. But the stigma does not arise from the existence of the child. The stigma arises from the actions of the parents. The child is just the outward evidence that those activities were engaged in. And by the way, do you know where that stigma is absolutely the worst? In church. We're the worst. You know, it's funny, I train pastors sometimes, and during my training with them, I say, wouldn't it be great, just for counseling purposes, wouldn't it be great if every single time somebody sinned, there was a corresponding physical manifestation? Sure, yeah, so pastors out there shaking hands as people walk out. Hey, Steve. Hey, Pastor. Hey, Steve. See you. Still dealing with envy. I got this big green cloud over my head, dude. I can't just seem to, can't get it away. Right? And they go, yeah, that'd be great. Until they realized it would include them. Suddenly, not so keen on that. Folks, sexual sin is a sin. It's a sin like a lot of other sins. By the way, can I see the hands of all the sin-free people in the room? Good call. Now imagine that every sin you committed had a corresponding physical manifestation. Sometimes, do you have any right to look down your nose at a 15-year-old girl who walks in with her belly all swollen? You don't know anything about her, her life, her circumstances. For all you know, that boy, she only ever had relations with him once. By the way, you know, the people who say, oh, you can't get pregnant the first time, that's not true. Okay. He loved her, said he was going to marry her. And one night in the back of Dad's Buick, they have relations once. Felt really bad about it. They prayed about it, asked forgiveness for it. But you know what? Biology's a stubborn thing. And she's got a baby. Right? Going to judge her? Do you know, I actually talked with the center director. They had let a girl do it, just like the girl I'm describing, let her to come to know Jesus. She went to a church and said, hey, you know, we've led her to Christ, but we don't really have the skill set or the time to disciple her to maturity. We'd love to enfold her into your church body. And this guy looked at her and he said, you know, I just don't think a pregnant 16-year-old girl would be a good fit at our church. Wow. Yeah, my response was, you need a different job. Right? You're not in the right job. We need to have the same kind of compassion for her as we'd have for anybody else. Now, I'll tell you the truth, man. If a girl walks in and she says, yep, had sex with my boyfriend last night. You know what I'm going to do tonight? I'm going to have sex with my boyfriend. And then I'm going to go to my youth group. I'm going to tell all the girls to have sex with their boyfriend. That girl's got to go. Okay. But I always ask pastors, you ever meet a girl like that? No. No, the girl comes in. You know what she's doing? She's sobbing. I violated my own principles. I let my parents down. I let my friends down. I feel so horrible. And now who's going to want to date me? I can't go to prom. You know, my Christian school is going to kick me out. Right? Nothing happens to the guy, of course. Never lay a finger on the guy. But folks, this is the kind of stigma we're looking for. And I'm just telling you, we need to look at those people with the same grace and mercy that we would like extended to us if we ever found ourselves in a compromising position. By the way, if you read my book, you're going to find, and it's a terrible thing, you know, those babies get created because of sex, right? The number of Christians who are completely enslaved to pornography right now is unbelievably high. And we're going to look down our nose at her? Yeah, I think not. What about the age of the mother? She's too young, she's too old. We can't have babies having babies. By the way, heads up, babies cannot have babies because they don't have fully developed reproductive systems. Only people with fully developed reproductive systems can have babies. And once their body's ready to have babies, they can have babies.
Like Mary.
Okay? Then on the elderly side, people say, well, when you're old, your child might have an enhanced risk of neural tube defects. Folks, whether you are too young to parent or you are too old and don't want to parent, there's always the option of adoption. By the way, words I would like excised from your vocabulary. Please do not say, give up your child for adoption. They don't do that anymore. It evokes images of like a gothic castle on a hill run by evil nuns, right? And the wayward girl is hauled off up there in the middle of the night. She gives birth to her child, and the child is snatched away and handed some ruffians who speed off in a sedan, right? I mean, that's the kind of image you get. It's not how it works, folks. The way it works is a birth mother decides, makes a decision that she would like to place her child for adoption. They bring in binders filled with parents, all of whom want to adopt that child. She can read about them. They'll have letters in them and descriptions of their family, where they live, brothers and sisters, all that. And then the woman, the birth mother, she gets to pick the family, and then she gets to negotiate how much time she will be able to spend with her child. Some of these adoptions are completely closed. She does not want to have any further contact. She places the child and that's it. Some women negotiate a tremendous amount of contact. I actually met a gal. She had negotiated. She got to see her kid once a month. And they got family photos and she's in them. And the kid graduates from high school. She's in the photo. Right? Anywhere to either extreme or anywhere in between, whatever the birth mom wants to negotiate. But the important thing to communicate to people is the power to choose remains with the birth mother. Nobody's going to force her, snatch her, make her do anything she doesn't want. No, she's going to have opportunities to craft the best possible life for her child. What about fetal abnormality and the stresses associated with it? Like I said, anybody with a healthy child, one accident away from having one with special needs. Folks, we don't get to kill kids because they're burdensome. Outside the womb, why should we be allowed to kill them inside the womb? And by the way, any guys ever met people with Down syndrome? I'm not gonna argue that this is true universally, but to a large degree, people who I've met with Down syndrome, they're happy people. In fact, if you've ever read Randy Alcorn's book, Deadline, if you haven't, I'd recommend it. In his version of heaven, all of the teachers have the distinguishing marks of Down syndrome on their face. They're maintained in the afterlife and turned into a thing of tremendous beauty. It'll make you cry when you read it. The unborn is an undesired gender. Here in the West, I would just call that shallow, right? But we know that in some other countries, they truly prize male children, and so if the child is determined to be female, they put that child to death. And as a result, of course, in some countries, China, for example, there's a tremendous gender imbalance between men and women. And I got news for you. You know, historically, not being able to find women for your men has been a reason why nations have gone to war. Right? You literally have millions of men not only can't find a wife, could not possibly get a wife because there aren't enough women for the men. That's where they're at over there. And folks, here's the other thing. Desires are transitory. I've got a friend of mine, big man's man, you know, competitive tennis player, black belt in karate. Good friend of mine. He and his wife tried to have kids, couldn't have kids, tried medical intervention, didn't work, went on a missions trip. You know where this is going. 42 years old, go on a missions trip to Budapest, and without any medical intervention of any kind, get pregnant with their daughter, Alyssa, who, by the way, is one of my favorite human beings ever. But when they found out she was pregnant, you can imagine, right, Barry's out there going, I just can't wait for my wife to produce a man cub. I'm going to take him out, and we're going to go hunting, we're going to go fishing, I'm going to teach him how to field dress a deer. It's going to be awesome. Right? But then little Adam turns out to be little Alyssa, and the next thing you know, it's all about tea parties, tutus, and watching Project Runway together. Right? Right? Daddy-daughter dances. Feelings are fleeting. They're transitory. People change. So Linda, all those girls who come in and take those pregnancy tests, and they're all, oh God, I don't want to be pregnant. My parents are going to kill me. It's going to be horrible. 7 months later, when they deliver, do they still feel like that? Yeah, they got pictures. Babies come out. God's smart, man. Babies are cute. Right? And by the way, we've been host home to women in our home who've been pregnant. We get kicked out. One of them kicked out by her parents. One of them kicked out by her husband because they would not abort the husband's child. One of them kicked out. Parents kicked her out. Then found out later on she was having twins. They wanted her to abort those twins. Mm-hmm. Amazing thing happened when the baby came out. Family reunification. Right? My parents are going to kill me. No, no, they're not. Your baby's going to come out. They're going to go, oh, Grandpa. Right? That's what happens. 9 times out of 10. I'm not going to tell you that people don't sometimes become permanently estranged. It does happen. Pretty rare. Pretty rare. The unborn child is unwanted and therefore will become a problem for itself or for society. Planned Parenthood, every child a wanted child. Folks, I got news for you. Every child is a wanted child. Every child is a wanted child. They just may not be wanted by their own biological parents, but they are wanted. There is a waiting list to adopt children. Depending on which stats you read, it's between 7 and 14 families for every available child to be adopted. Now, some people will say, well, there's 900,000 abortions. Are you going to adopt all of them? Right? That's the argument. I say, yep, it's not true. You're not going to adopt 900,000 children. Let's all be honest. Here's the deal, though. There was this interesting book came out. It was called The Turnaway Study. Any of you guys see that book, Turnaway Study? Nobody? Okay. This is a book that talked about women who'd gone in for abortions and got turned away. Now, the most interesting stat in this book is actually buried later in the book. So some of these women, they went, they got turned away, and then later on, they found somebody to abort their children, and they had abortions. Some of the women got turned away, went home, and had their babies. Then they evaluated how satisfied people were with the outcome. As you might imagine, the women who had abortions, almost all of them said they were happy with their decision. I mean, what are they going to say? Now, we know, those of us who work in pregnancy center work, know that a lot of people either immediately or later on down the line terribly regret the abortions in their life. But obviously, publicly, they're going to say, yep, best decision I ever made. That's not the important or interesting stat to me. The interesting stat to me is that the women who got turned away and then did not manage to get an abortion, they were almost overwhelmingly glad they didn't. And what that tells me is that if these women had not been able to get an abortion and had instead also had their children, they too would have been very glad they had their children. So this idea that every child has to be a wanted child at the moment you find out you have a child is nuts. But what we know from experience is that many people who start out with, oh, this is a horrible thing that I'm pregnant right now, when the baby finally arrives, because it's not like that, right? You don't look at the stick, see the two little lines, and then suddenly, and here's a kid. It takes like another 7 months or so. And during that time, people's hearts change. And the kind of argument that Planned Parenthood makes human beings out to be static creatures who, once something happens, they can't ever shift at all. It assumes that not wanting children is an unalterable condition. It is not. If an embryo or a fetus can be killed because it will not be loved, why can't a born child be killed because it will not be loved? And like I told you, you're going to find out here in a little bit, there are people who are actively making that argument. Now, I'm going to just briefly insert here a word about abortion and crime rates. There was an article that came out a long time ago, and it said, hey, you know, we need abortion because after 1973, we had a steep decline in crime. So abortion is positively correlated with a decrease in crime rates. And you know what? They're right. It is. You want to know why? because most crimes are committed between generally young men between the ages of about 16 and 26. So when you wipe out, when one out of every three to one out of every four pregnancies end in abortion, you wipe out a lot of potential criminals, and so your crime rate goes down. So here's the deal. I don't know, what's the crime rate in Oklahoma City like? Is it pretty high, pretty low? How is it? High, okay. What if I told you that tomorrow I could make Oklahoma City crime-free? Exciting, right? I can. All you have to do is kill all the people. See, right? If you kill all of the people, there won't be any crime. Now, see, this is the kind of way these guys are working these stats. What they never want to tell you is all of those children who were aborted, yes, there were criminals among them. But there were also people who were going to grow up and become cops. People who were going to grow up to become judges. People who were going to grow up to be jail, orderlies. Then some of those people were going to grow up and they were going to be Sunday school teachers who were going to get to that kid before they became a criminal, lead them to Jesus. The kid would go off to Africa, lead thousands of people to Christ. Right? There's no way to know. But we value human life and we don't prejudge it. We don't live in Minority Report where we know somebody's going to commit a crime. And so we eliminate them now. Because there's all kinds of things that can intervene along the way. So all human life is valuable. We protect those human lives. And until you engage in an activity that puts you at risk for incarceration, you should be free to live. Now, what about this planet is overpopulated? Jacqueline Kaysen wrote a book years ago called The War Against Population. I actually got a chance to meet her. One of the very first statewide organizations I spoke to was the California Pro-Life Council, and she happened to be on the program, and I got to meet her. She was an economist at Humboldt State University, so she's not a theologian. And she went and just kind of crunched the numbers. And what she discovered was you could take every human being on the face of this planet, you could put them all inside of the state of Texas, all of them, and the state of Texas would be less densely populated than many urban areas in the country. Okay, that means everybody be in the state of Texas, the rest of the world would be devoid of human life. Now, some of you have seen these little bar maps they came out with, I think it was about a year and a half ago, where they have, basically what you see is like the United States is flat, and on the coast there's a bunch of spiky areas, and then a couple of other spiky metro areas, and the rest of it is nothing. By the way, I didn't need a big, expensive national survey to prove this to me. All you need is a plane ticket. Right? You get on a plane and you fly. Now, by the way, you want to notice almost all of these population control organizations, they're always housed in New York City. If I lived in New York City, I would think we were overpopulated too. But you drive across the United States, what you're going to see is there's not very many people. And I'm going to tell you, years and years and years, I'm going to age myself, a guy named Ben Wattenberg wrote a book called The Birth Dearth. And he predicted ages ago we were going to hit peak humanity. And then when we dropped, it was going to be catastrophic. And guess what? You're in it right now. Right now, you're in it. This is why I really believe the church, I'm so glad Paul's here because I know he'll just grab hold of this and run with it. What the church needs to do is it needs to teach its people to obey God. That first commandment. Be fruitful and multiply. By the way, never rescinded ever by God. Be fruitful and multiply. Now, in the last days, Jesus does say, woe to those, right? You're going to have trouble if you've got kids. But he doesn't say, so, don't have any. Doesn't say that. Just says it's going to be more difficult for you. We need to be having kids. God, I told people this morning, God has two plans for human beings. Number one, very small sliver of you, he has given you the gift of celibacy. And by the way, when you've been single too long and people ask you if you got that gift, most people go, no, I don't. Seriously, I don't. Okay? Gift of celibacy. For the rest of you, you know what God's plan is? Get married and form families. That's God's plan. But you know what we're too busy doing? Well, I know I do want to form a family, but that guy in my youth group who I know is really godly and a really neat guy, I've known him for a long time, well, he's not as hot as this guy or this guy or this guy that I've never actually met, and I think he lives in Omaha, but he's available, right? Right? This is what our culture is telling people, and it's telling them, don't get married, and if you do, don't have kids. It's about yourself. Take care of yourself. And yeah, you're going to take care of yourself, and you're going to find yourself 60 years old, 70 years old, your apartment's going to be filled with cats, and you're going to die, and no one's going to even know who you are. God's plan for you, now, by the way, and I feel for you, my wife and I went through infertility, and so some people, they try to have kids, and they can't, but God's ultimate plan, I think, would be for us to form families and have, and if you can't have, then adopt children and raise children up in the fear and admonition of the Lord. Now, this one I don't think is in your notes. If it is, I updated it and forgot. You're going to hear people tell you, if abortion is made illegal, thousands of women will die. Bernard Nathanson, one of the founding members of NARAL, who later on, a hardcore abortionist, later on flipped over, became pro-life, and became, throughout the rest of his life, an ardent pro-life supporter. He wrote a book called The Abortion Papers, and he said, you know what? We actually pulled a number out of the air. We said 5 to 10,000 women a year were going to die from illegal abortions. He said, I knew when we said it, it was a lie. It was just a nice, round, shocking figure. And he said, we pulled it out of thin air. You can imagine that people who are willing to kill children have no problem with lying about it. Okay? Mary Calderon, the medical director of Planned Parenthood, told everybody when? Oh, in 1957, that illegal abortions were safe with a low death rate. And it's true. A very low death rate for women, an unbelievably high death rate for unborn children. Virtually 100% of those children die. Now, one death from abortion is too many. And while abortion, like I said, physically safe for the woman, nearly 100% lethal for the unborn. But right now, we got people up in Capitol Hill trying to draw a link between maternal mortality rates and abortion. They're saying, hey, if you get rid of abortion, maternal mortality rates are going to go up. Lots of women are going to die because they don't have access to abortion because it's absolutely positively health care. Okay, in a February 2020 article on NBC's website, by the way, can we all agree that NBC is not an organ of the National Right to Life movement? Okay, listen to what they report. Washington, D.C. is singled out for its high maternal mortality rate. In other words, got a lot of women get pregnant and die. Worse than Syria during a war. And yet D.C. has no restrictions on abortion. So if that correlation were true, maternal mortality rates in D.C. should be unbelievably low. Now, I'm going to make it clear, right? We've got to address maternal mortality rates wherever they occur. I'm going to let you know that a lot of the maternal mortality rates have nothing to do with abortion, but have to do with other health problems that people have. But abortion is absolutely not the solution to maternal mortality issues. So then we get into what I call the final shift. The final shift is we just unmask abortion extremists. Folks, advocates just now, they just admit that it's actually a human life. So I got this wonderful article here. The title of the article kind of tells it all. This is in Salon Magazine back in 2015. The title of the article is, So What If Abortion Ends a Life? Okay. At the end of the article, it's written up by a gal named Mary Elizabeth Williams. She says, in an op-ed on why I'm pro-choice in the Michigan Daily this week, Emma Manier stated quite perfectly that some argue that abortion takes lives, but I know that abortion saves lives too. Then Mary Elizabeth picks it up and she says, she understands that it saves lives, not just in the most medically literal way, but in the roads that women who have choice get to go down, in the possibilities for them and for their families. And I would put the life of a mother over the life of a fetus every single time, even if I need to acknowledge my conviction that a fetus is indeed a life worth sacrificing. Now, let me tell you what she's doing in this, and our opponents do this all the time. They're using the word life, but they're using it in two very distinctly different ways. On the one hand, we have the medically significant way. In other words, a woman's got an ectopic pregnancy, and she needs to be treated, otherwise she's going to die. Her physical life is at stake. On the other hand, though, it's lifestyle choices. The roads we get to go down, the choices we get to make, right? I thought it was intriguing that she said, for herself and her family. Which she's arguing she shouldn't have. Okay? But on the other side, abortion, the only way that abortion affects that unborn child is to take its actual physical life. So she's using the word equivocally. Same word, two meanings, and hoping you don't notice. The life of the mother over the life of the fetus. That's not truth in advertising would be, I would put the life of the mother, frankly, I'll put even the choices that that mother wants to have later on, to have more kids, not have more kids, go on a trip, and the pregnancy's kind of gotten in the way of her flying over there. I put all of those things over the actual physical life of her child every single time. That's what she really means. But she doesn't say it because they're trying to fool you. So, they know. They don't care if it's a human life, the mother's freedom outweighs. By the way, not like Bill Clinton used to say, not safe, legal, but rare. Now the new placards, the bumper sticker is abortion, on demand and without apology. Dr. Colleen McNicholas, the chief medical officer of Planned Parenthood of St. Louis, in a Senate committee hearing on Tuesday, July 12th, just last year, called on the Biden administration, this is immediately post-Dobbs, called on the Biden administration to declare, this killed me, a national health emergency in response to the Dobbs decision. She argued, this defies any rational analysis, she argued that being against abortion is anti-life. She says, abortion is normal. It is an act of love, and it is fundamentally healthcare. By the way, they never just say it's healthcare anymore. They always say now it's absolutely healthcare, fundamentally healthcare. They use some massive superlative on it to make it, to really drive down the point, it's healthcare. This is only possible if you happen to believe that unborn children are tumors or parasites. And by the way, there are people out there who tell you unborn children are parasites. News for you from biology class, a parasite never is the same organism as its host. Okay? Doesn't work like that. They're your children. They're your offspring, and they're connected to you because that's where they naturally belong. It's not like there's a bunch of embryos floating around in the atmosphere, and you go to sleep one night and wake up, wow, where'd that come from? Right? My wife and I struggled with infertility for a while. People always say, I don't know about you, but for us, I turned around twice when we were pregnant, and I looked at my wife and I said, we've been doing it wrong. People talk about it like it's magic somehow, you know? So unborn children, they're not tumors. Unborn children are not parasites. And pregnancy is not a disease. Right? Children are the natural outcome of sexual intercourse. And pregnancy is a normal condition. I will tell you what. I was stunned. CNN, this is just July 6th this year. They described the effect of the pro-life protection laws in Texas. Listen to what they tweeted out. A strict abortion law that took effect in Texas in 2021 may have led to nearly 10,000 more births than expected. In the last 9 months of 2022, according to research, this shows you how great these authors are. According to research published in the journal JAMA, which is kind of a problem because the journal JAMA is the journal of the American Medical Association. Suzanne Bell, the co-author of the study, who studies patterns of contraceptive use and abortion, chimed in. There were still a lot of people who were going further afield for abortion care or who were self-managing their abortions. But our results suggest that not everyone was able to overcome those barriers, and many were forced to carry an unwanted or unsafe pregnancy to term. Oh my gosh, they had babies! Wow! That's a shocker! They got pregnant and then they gave birth. They're talking about it like this is an unusual thing to happen. These people are out of their minds. By the way, Planned Parenthood says it's no longer enough to be pro-choice. No. On their page it says, they're talking about things people say, right? No one is pro-abortion, or I'm pro-choice, not pro-abortion. Then they write, typically it's people who are supportive of abortion rights who use these phrases, but they both imply that abortion is a bad thing. It's 100% fine to support abortion. Be proud to be pro-abortion. 20 years ago, if on a debate stage, I would have called my opponent a pro-abort, they would have lost their minds. Nobody's pro-abortion. Oh, yeah? Planned Parenthood says everybody should be. So I freely and have always called my opponents what they are. They are abortion advocates. That's what they are. In my book, I call them abortion choice advocates because they are in favor of people making a choice for abortion. I thought that was really fair. If I rewrite this book or the new book I'm working on called Pivot, all the gloves are off, man. You're pro-aborts. That's what you are. And you know what? It's what you say you are. I will be honest and call you what you want to be called. They also tell me that there's no problem with late-term abortions that having multiple abortions. And, oh, they also say there's no such thing as the abortion industry, which I find fascinating because I'm not really sure then who the National Abortion Federation represents. Okay? These people lie. And then finally, folks, some people just revel in it. In Cosmopolitan magazine, May 3rd, 2014, abortion clinic worker Emily Letts, she went out and she was a counselor at an abortion facility. And girls would come in and they'd say, well, have you had an abortion? And she'd say, well, no, I haven't had an abortion. So she got really excited when she found out that her boyfriend had impregnated her. Not because she wanted to have a baby, because now she could have an abortion. She didn't want just any kind of abortion, though. She found out early enough she could have taken an abortion pill, but she chose to let her child gestate and grow inside of her abdomen so that she could have a surgical abortion because she wanted to film it. So she went in, got on the table. They brought in a film crew. She had people hold her hands, give her all this kind of moral support, which I always find fascinating. I had rotator cuff surgery, and nobody held my hand, right? She knew what she was doing, right? And so they film it. They edit the footage. They submit it to a short film contest, and it wins. By the way, I've seen the film. It is not a film of her abortion. It's a film of her face while she's having an abortion. I showed you what the aftermath of an abortion really looks like, and that was nowhere to be seen in this film. At the end of the article, she says, "Still, every time I watch the video, I love it." So this is a woman who watches repeatedly over and over and over again film footage of her taking the life of her unborn child, and her response is that she loves it. In Vice 2019, abortionist Zoe Thill puts on abortion workshops. She takes average everyday citizens like herself, to bring them into a workshop, and she hands them an aspiration abortion device and a papaya, which stands in for the uterus. She says, "Take the cannula, pop it in the papaya, and let's see if we can't suck the seeds out. If you do, that's a successful papaya abortion. Not a big deal." Well, some of the people get a little excited, so they push on it a little too hard, and it pops out the other side, which, in a real abortion, will be called perforating the uterus, and it is a life-threatening medical complication. But she says, "Oh, you know," and he laughs about it. And she says, "Oh, we don't shame perforators here." Now, some of the people, they successfully manage to extract the seeds, and they get rather excited about their successful papaya abortion. And then Zoe Thill walks up to them and says, "Oh, it's even more satisfying when it's a real abortion." These are some of the kinds of people that we are confronting on the other side of this issue. We've got this, yeah, they're demonic. We have this weird idea that everybody's rational but wrong. These people are committed and spiritually so. We have people now arguing for infanticide, involuntary euthanasia. I'll get to that in a minute. So finally, I want to get to one last thing before we get to the biblical case for life, and I'm going to have to really rush because we got to get done. Some people say, "You haven't been rushing already?" Yeah. Wait till I turn it up a notch. I want to answer some questions about whether women should be punished under the law for having an abortion. Okay. The reason why pro-abortion opponents ask you this question is to prove that you really don't value life. Because the knee-jerk reaction of most pro-life people is, well, no, we're not going to. The law has never punished women for having an abortion. And generally speaking, that's been true. So what they'll say is, so you don't really believe that the child in a woman's body is really a human being, because if you did, you'd punish her. Now, if you do say, yeah, we would punish her, oh, you're anti-woman. So if you're a Trekkie, this is what's called a Kobayashi Maru scenario, right? It's the unwinnable scenario. So you ask yourself, well, how do I respond to this? I'm going to help you up. The response is, start off by exposing the fallacy. Just simply say, look, if I tell you I'm not going to punish women, you're going to tell me I'm inconsistent. If I tell you I am going to punish women, you're going to tell me that I'm anti-woman. So explain to me, what's the winning strategy here? So tell you what, you want to ask me some questions? I want to ask you some questions. Can different kinds of intentional killing lead to different kinds of punishment? Let me give you three scenarios. Scenario number one, there's a guy, he's a cold-blooded hitman. He gets up on tall buildings and gets money paid to him and bang, bang, kills people, you know, for dough. Complete strangers. Scenario number two, woman comes home a little bit early from work, pops into the bedroom, notices that her husband is in bed with his secretary, knows there's a shotgun in the closet, pulls it out, bang, bang, kills both of them. Scenario number three, guy and his wife are late to the theater, they take a shortcut through an alley. They are confronted by a robber who pulls out a wicked-looking knife. He says, "Give me your wallet and give me your watch." And the guy gives him his wallet and his watch because, after all, there is no material possession that's worth more than a human life, even this guy's. And the guy says, he senses now he's got an easy mark. He says, "Okay, now get down on your knees, man, because I'm going to rape your wife and then kill both of you." And the guy reaches back in his waistband, pulls out a handgun, and empties the entire magazine into the guy's chest. Okay? Now, can we all agree these are three instances of intentional killing? Okay? Now, what should happen to these people? So to the hitman, what kind of punishment happens to the hitman? Death penalty, right? This is special circumstances kind of stuff. What about the woman who kills her husband, finding him in bed with his secretary? Now, we have a name for that kind of crime, right? It's a crime of passion. She's not going to be punished in the same way that this guy, that the hitman's going to be punished. Be very, very different. Now, what about the guy who's going through the alley with his wife? What's going to happen to that guy? Nut, might get a medal, right? Because he killed a guy who was actively threatening the life of himself and his wife. Three acts of intentional killing, three different responses. So what I tell people is, I really don't have any idea legally what we will do once we truly criminalize abortion, which I believe that we must. Abortionists, however, will surely be punished because in these scenarios, abortionists are hitmen. They kill strangers for money. Right? And they know. They're all medical doctors. They know exactly what they're doing. They can't plead innocence. Now, you've got a nation of people who for more than 50 years have been inculcated with the idea that what's in their body is just a blob of tissue. They don't believe that there's anything going on there. They don't think that there's anything wrong with ending a pregnancy because they've been told all their life. By the way, not just by anybody, by the government. Our government, I mean, California's got an abortion.ca.gov website directing women to abortion facilities. Intriguingly, here in Oklahoma, your governor just created a life-oriented website that directs women to pregnancy centers. So, right, we have life states and death states. But what do we do for women who've lived their entire life in a death state and don't know what's true? Do you immediately impose the harshest possible punishment on them? I don't know. But I will tell you this. Remember I told you it's a good idea sometimes to say, I don't know? Because legally, I don't know what people will be able to politically manage to have happen. But I will tell you this. I don't think it would have been a good idea back after the Emancipation Proclamation if somebody would have stepped up and said, hey, Abe, you know, until we can figure out all the details, like, I mean, where are we going to house these people? How are we going to feed them? You know, are they going to get 40 acres and a mule or what? I mean, well, what are we going to do with all these slaves? I mean, you know, until we can figure out all the policy details, we probably ought to just leave things the way they are. No, when you know something's immoral and wrong, you stop it. And then you work out the policy details later. So how women fit into this is unknown. We're going to have to deal with generations of cultural context. But so this is how our opponents argue in retreat, right? It's not a human being. Yes, it is. Here's all the evidence. Okay. Not a human being. It's a human being, all right. But it's not like it's a person or anything. No, there's no distinguishing standards between human beings and persons other than to create a category of human beings that's morally permissible to kill, and the standards that you give put every human being at risk. Oh, okay. Well, let's just forget about all that. And what about rape and incest? Aren't you guys, you're pitiless, horrible monsters? Well, let's take a look at that and see who's really the pitiless, horrible. Gosh, things aren't looking very good for you. Oh, okay. So, all right. So you guys do care for women, and I get it. But, you know, women, pregnancy impacts them in a way that makes it inequitable for them to be pregnant in a way that men. And we need a society full of equity and inclusion. And in order to do that, we need to have abortion. And then we look at every single one of the arguments that they propose. And all of them assume that the unborn aren't human. Doesn't prove that they aren't. It just assumes that they aren't. So if we go back to, it's a human being. In fact, it's a human being who's a person. And none of these arguments justify the killing of human beings in order to relieve current and often temporary examples of suffering. Right? I have never in all of the days as a debate coach, we sponsored debates on the abortion issue all the time. I never ever saw a pro-life debater lose that debate. And I don't mean like in my opinion. I mean, we used to have a division of the house, so my secular students would come in, sit on the side of the room they agreed with, and at the end of the debate, they went out the door of the person they thought that won. You can imagine at the beginning of the debate, it was very lopsided. By the end of the debate, it was still lopsided, but in the other direction. Because here's the deal. Ladies and gentlemen, you got to understand, you are some of the few people in this country that have ever heard a cogent, complete case for the sanctity of human life. Most people in this country have never contemplated it. Where are they going to hear it? Is the government going to tell it to them? No. Medical community going to tell it to them? No. Public school system going to expose them to it? No. How about celebrities? No. Celebrities aren't going to do it. It's got to happen in the church. It's got to happen in the church. But I hate to call people out, folks. Oklahoma City is a big place. This room shouldn't have been able to hold the number of people who should have been here tonight.
Amen.
Good news, though, is you're here. And I'm about to deputize you in a minute. So, let's move on to session number 3 here real quick. The biblical case for life, probably don't have to go in a great detail here. I'm hoping most of you understand these things, so I'm going to go through them pretty quick. But it's important for you to understand the Guttmacher stats on religious affiliation and women seeking abortions. Right, so German Jones and Onda in Characteristics of U.S. Abortion Patients in 2014 and Changes Since 2008. This was published in 2016. They said, abortion patients were 24% Catholic, 17% mainline Protestant, 13% evangelical Protestant. Add that together, that's 54% of all women seeking abortions claim some affiliation with the church. I've been telling the church for literally decades, if you want to shut Planned Parenthood down, stop sending our people to them. If we will tell people the truth from the pulpit, if people can understand, if we support our pregnancy centers and help people to know there is hope for you, even if you make a mistake with your boyfriend, there's hope for you, and we aren't going to shame you. We're going to welcome you back into the family of God. It's going to be awesome. We could have shut Planned Parenthood down years ago because they could not exist. Literally, couldn't keep the doors open at 46% of their current volume. Lifeway Research in 2015 said more than 4 in 10 women who have had an abortion were churchgoers when they ended a pregnancy. That's over 40%. Only 7% discussed it with anybody at church. Just over half say that no one at church knows it. Nearly half of the women who've had an abortion, 49%, say a pastor's teaching on forgiveness doesn't seem to apply to terminated pregnancies. So you wonder why they won't come and talk to us? They feel like they're going to be shamed and experience stigma. I tell you, I had met with an elder at a church one time who looked me dead in the eye and said, "That's the problem, is the church needs to go back to shaming people." And I went, "Really? Why don't we start with you then?" Sinned lately? Surveys on Christians referring for abortion. I did this survey. I surveyed over 1,000 college students across the country. It was a really cool research instrument, very, very deep. Nobody had any idea there was anything about abortion. It was supposed to be about free speech issues in the classroom. But one of the things that that professors sometimes don't let their students talk about is abortion, because, you know, it's overdone, everybody's already made up their mind, it's not a big deal, right? I hear that kind of stuff. So I thought, well, if it's overdone, students should know a lot about abortion then. So I surveyed them. Well, buried in that survey was the question, if a woman had an untimely pregnancy, to what local organization would you refer her? At the state universities where I did this, every single one of them had a pregnancy resource center or clinic nearby. 57% of the students wrote, didn't bubble it in, had to write up, come up with a name out of their head, wrote Planned Parenthood. Do you know what kind of marketing penetration that is? 39% said, "I don't know." That's 96% of the students either don't know or are going to send her to Planned Parenthood, where they will surely put that child to death. Less than 4% mentioned the pregnancy center. Then I repeated the survey at a large evangelical Christian university with 7 fully licensed pregnancy centers all around it. Asked them the same question. Number one answer, 53%, don't know. How could you not know? You have 7 centers all around your campus. You are an evangelical university where you'd expect them to talk about life issues. 53% don't know. But what 42% though, they said Planned Parenthood. Add those numbers together, 95% of students don't know or are going to send that woman to Planned Parenthood. By the way, asked a follow-up question. If you named an organization, can you tell me where it's located? 80% of the students who wrote Planned Parenthood told me where it was located. Some of them so specifically, they gave me the cross streets in the building it was behind. 6.5%, give or take, said the pregnancy center. Now, that add that up, it's more than 100. You know why? Because these Christian students said, "Oh, well, if she wants to keep the baby, we send her to the pregnancy center. And if she doesn't, we send her to Planned Parenthood." What's the solution? We have to inoculate the church by teaching the case for life. Christians need to know the scientific and moral case for life, the one you're learning here tonight, to reach those who don't share their biblical presuppositions. Right? You walk in, you start talking about the Bible, and people just immediately shut down because they don't believe in that. I can make a complete and total case for life without resorting to the Scriptures. Okay? Now, if people talk to me and ask me about my faith, I'm certainly going to share it. If they tell me I'm post-abortive and have no hope, I'm going to certainly share with them the hope in Jesus Christ. But I can make a case from science and moral philosophy that you ought not kill other human beings. It shouldn't be that difficult, folks. Christians need to know the biblical case for life, though, to be able to teach their people to value children and resist abortion advocacy. And so this is how we do it. Number one, we need to understand God's intention toward human beings. Human beings are image bearers of God. That's what Genesis 1:27 tells us. God forms us in the womb and he knows us, right? You read in Psalm 139 verses 13 through 16, right? How God forms us, how God weaves us, how God knows us in our mother's womb. How God has numbered our days, and as yet there were not was not yet one of them, right? Skillfully wrought. We hear about how God interacts with his children even as they are being woven together in their mother's womb. We are told in Genesis 1:22, we're supposed to be fruitful and we're supposed to multiply. And also, and this is something we need to talk a whole lot more about, in Psalm 127:3, we're told that children are both a gift and a reward. Now some people say, "Oh, now wait a minute, Dr. Newman. That girl's 15 years old. How in the world can you say that that child is a reward and a gift for her?" And my response is, may I see the hands of all the omniscient people in the room? Good answer. See, God knows things we don't. By the way, that promise doesn't mean that there's no guarantee that kid's not going to turn out to be a bad one. People do bad things. They go off on the wrong track. But that doesn't mean God doesn't have some kind of a plan for that child's life, even if that plan is to be difficult and become an object of grace and mercy to other people and that God will use that child to form other people into the image of his son. You don't know. We don't step in and kill them because we don't know. God condemns the killing of the innocent. The murder of human beings is forbidden. I don't think I have to unpack Exodus 20:13 for you. But the killing of children is an abomination associated with idol worship. In Jeremiah 32:35, they built the high places of Baal that are in the valley of Ben-Hinnom to cause their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire to Molech, which I had not commanded them, nor had it entered my mind that they should do this abomination to cause Judah to sin. So what happened? Back in the Old Testament, right? You've got the Israelites rolling around. By the way, Solomon, some of Solomon's wives sacrificed his children to Molech. Okay, so they got the temple. It's right there. You can go down and inquire at the temple and find out about God's will. But, you know, things were kind of odd back in those days. Sometimes God would give the priest some kind of interesting knowledge about you. Maybe you've been doing something wrong, and that's why your crops are failing. So you kind of know that about yourself, and so you don't go to the temple. You decide you want a second opinion. So you go down into the valley of Ben-Hinnom. You go up in the high place, and you say, hey, got this problem. They say, no problem. The great God Molech can solve your problem. Just come on back, and this time bring your kid. And so they would come, and they would bring their child. And by the way, there are places like Carthage where they have these places called Tophets. And in these, you can find little scrolls. You know, hope my sacrifice is acceptable to the God. And the bones of children are buried there. So they bring their child up. Now, the sacrifice has got to be willing. So what they would do is they would take some of the priest's assistants would have these big drums. And they would beat loudly on these drums to drown out the screams of the children. Molech was this huge bronze idol. And it had a body that looked like a man with outstretched arm and a big hole in the belly where a fire was blazing. And on top was a head of a bull. They would place that child in the arms, roll it into the belly. The child's body would be incinerated. And that was the sacrifice. Intriguing thing, both Baal and Molech were fertility gods. Old Testament Molech worship. What do we do today? Girl's got a problem. Just like back then, they had a problem. Girl has a problem. She either wants her life to stay the way it is, and she knows if she's pregnant that her boyfriend said he's going to leave her. Parents said they're going to kick her out. She wants to keep the life she's got, or she has opportunities out there, and the child's going to get in the way of those opportunities. Now, there are churches on every... I've been driving around Edmond. There are churches everywhere. She's going to drive right past them. You want to know why? She knows what the pastor's going to tell her, or she thinks she does. So she wants to go seek out a second opinion. So she drives up to the family planning clinic, right? She walks in. The receptionist says, oh, so glad you're here. Oh, don't worry about it. You don't really have anything really going on here. It's so small. It's not just a blob of tissue. It's no big deal at all. And I'm telling you, right, we can solve your problem. All you have to do is make a donation. I'm sorry, it's not a donation, is it? You have to actually write a check. $600 to $800. And then just walk down the yellow line. Now, they don't send her home to bring the kids. See, we've already enculturated our young people to bring them with them. They're in her body. Back in the old days, they didn't have the surgical ability to take those kids. But now we do. In fact, they have actually created particular surgical instruments that are specifically designed to take kids out piece by piece. Go on down the yellow line, get on the altar. Oh, did I say altar? Sorry. Table, surgical table. And then the doctor will come in. And he will wave his instruments over your body and inside of your body. And 15 minutes later, you'll be not pregnant. You'll never have to worry about it again. Never even think about it ever again. Except that's a lie, too. And then when the baby comes out in a surgical abortion, they actually array the baby's body parts on a light board to make sure they got all the parts. Because if they don't, they could leave a part in and that could lead to a life-threatening complication. And then you want to know what they do with those body parts when they're done? They go into a medical incinerator. Sound familiar? Or they sell them if they can. But actually, after Project Veritas exposed that, that I think got shut down a little bit. It's still happening. And I knew about it in the 1980s when Mark Crutcher... I actually used to have a green sheet that was a price list of aborted baby body parts. But the rest of them, yeah, they go into a medical incinerator. Sound familiar? Folks, you can't expect that Planned Parenthood is going to say this is the first church of Molech. But just because they don't say it doesn't mean that's not what it is. Okay, C.S. Lewis in his book, The Screwtape Letters, you know what he says? He says, our orders from the high command are at present to conceal ourselves. We lose the advantage of making magicians, and we can't terrorize anybody, but if we can get people to do the will of our father, the devil, without ever actually acknowledging it's him they're serving, all the better. They get all the advantages and don't have to give anything up. We have Molech worship today, and I am not here today, this evening, ladies and gentlemen, to tell you that abortion is like Molech worship. It's not. Abortion is Molech worship. We just are unwilling to put the name on it. Because we have this bizarre idea that idolatry is something that involves big, long idols that you get down and bow down. No. Idolatry is when we sacrifice things which are precious to God in order to gain an advantage we don't think we can get otherwise through someone who's not God. You know, little Billy having a baseball card collection, that's probably not idolatry. That's probably just he wants to be a Major League Baseball player and he admires these guys. Little Billy is not sacrificing his little brother by making a deal with the devil to become a Major League Baseball star. But that kind of deal is exactly what gets struck inside of Planned Parenthoods all over America. God's intentions toward, the blood guilt that people experience in this act, it extends both to the perpetrator and to passive bystanders. Right? Proverbs 24 says, deliver those who are being taken away to death and those who are staggering to slaughter. Oh, hold them back. If you say, see, we did not know this. Does he not consider it who weighs the heart? And does he not know it who keeps your soul? And will he not render to each man according to his work? So we can't just be a bystander and go, well, I didn't even know what was going on. You do know. We all know. And so as a result, we bear obligation. And abortion is positively, absolutely, despite what you heard in the Senate testimony, abortion is not loving our neighbor. By the way, that was the verse that Gavin Newsom put at the bottom of those horrible billboards. Love your neighbor as yourself. Okay? Yeah. So to Gavin Newsom, the way you love your neighbor is you help them kill their unborn children. There are a couple of common objections to these arguments. One of them is, if this is true, then miscarriage makes God or nature the biggest murderer or abortionist on the planet. Think about all the children who miscarry, for example. Other arguments they make is that God doesn't really see the unborn as equally valuable to adults. In Exodus 21, verses 22 and 23, we read, if men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely, and yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life. By the way, some people argue then that this means that abortion is permissible because God obviously doesn't see the value of the unborn child the same way as he sees the value of the woman carrying the child. Let's take a look at a couple of responses on miscarriage. Folks, life and death is God's jurisdiction, not ours. And I've got really bad news for you. God kills everybody. Everybody. You are all living under a curse. God has literally decreed that you will die. But God forbids you to intentionally take the life of an innocent human being. It's his jurisdiction, not yours. And what about this idea of human value? The Hebrew word yelet and the Greek word brephos, these words both mean child, and they mean child inside the womb and outside the womb. So when Elizabeth meets with Mary and her child leaps with joy, that's brephos, same word as children. Let the little children come to me. Right? These are the same words. In the case of this example from Exodus, the death involved here is unintentional. It doesn't say if two men grab a pregnant woman and beat her to death. It says if two men are struggling, and it seems as if they're arguing, and inadvertently strike a woman with child so that she gives birth prematurely. Now, some people say, oh, but it says, and if no future or no further harm follows, see, she gave birth prematurely, but the baby lived. No. All these people in the Old Testament, they knew what premature birth looked like. People still had premature birth back then. The children's lungs, they aren't fully developed and they die. There were no neonatal ICU units back in the Old Testament. But what I can tell you is this. The man strikes the woman. The baby does not die because the man struck the woman. The baby dies because the baby doesn't have fully formed lungs. It's effects causality, not direct causality. And that's what I think is the rationale for how this thing turns out. But the guy does not go unpunished. Did you see what it says? That he will be fined. Who gets to set the fine? The husband. In a culture where we value children, can you imagine what that fine would have looked like? So you still get punished. God punishes even the accidental loss of life. Just imagine if it were intentional. Okay, we're going to go through these last couple of sections. They're going to go quickly. I told you earlier, right, now that we understand this biblical case for life, I told you we were going to talk about how the abortion choice philosophy puts everybody at risk. There's always going to be a danger of establishing an arbitrary definition for who counts as one of us. Gary M. Atkinson, I think, wrote one of the most brilliant essays ever called The Morality of Abortion back in 1974. This was in the International Philosophical Quarterly. I want you to listen to what he says is going to happen once we make abortion legal. It is believed that the line can be drawn at birth, right, the separation line. But the line is arbitrary, and it will be recognized as such by future generations precisely because it will be in their best or in their self-interest to do so and to justify infanticide and euthanasia. Those who desire infanticide and euthanasia have been given all the justification they need by the arguments supporting abortion. The only thing that remains to be done is to tear down the tissue of rationalization that for the present acts as a barrier between abortion and euthanasia. Acceptance is first gained for abortion by emphasizing the irrelevant or even imaginary distinctions between the fetus and the newborn child. For example, one speaks of fetal tissue or developing human tissue or the products of pregnancy, while refusing to allow as proper any reference to the fetus as a child. Then, having justified killing the fetus, one proceeds to emphasize the similarities between the fetus and the infant, so as to justify killing the born child and finally the adult. He predicted this in 1974, and it's exactly these arguments that are being used by people who are trying to advance infanticide and euthanasia. So we're all at risk. Giblini and Minerva, I told you about these guys earlier. These guys wrote an essay. Their essay is phenomenal. It's called After Birth Abortion, Why Should the Baby Live? And it is not an essay that occurred in some obscure place. This is from the Journal of Medical Ethics, big name journal. I'm not going to bother you by reading the whole thing. I'm just going to let you know it kicks off by them saying if a woman could have an abortion for some reason, right after the baby's born, there's no reason why she shouldn't be able to kill the baby for the same reason. Because there's no real distinction between the baby inside and the baby outside the womb. Remember what I told you? They flipped it on its head. Since we could kill you then, we should be able to kill you now. But the chilling part is how this essay ends. I'm just going to read the... So they talk about the idea that they don't put forward any claim about the moment at which afterbirth abortion would no longer be permissible. I mean, gosh, why put a limit on it? They talk about how they might assess that, but the really scary part is at the end where they say, abortion at an earlier stage is the best option, both for psychological and physical reasons. However, if a disease has not been detected during the pregnancy, if something went wrong during the delivery, or if economical, social, or psychological circumstances change such that the taking care of the offspring becomes an unbearable burden on someone, then people should be given the chance of not being forced to do something they cannot afford. That little word salad-y sentence here basically says, if you no longer want your kids, you should be able to kill them. Folks, we're looking at ancient Roman child exposure and death, that kind of philosophy. By the way, when this first came out, they got a ton of pushback, and they kind of backpedaled. Oh, we're just philosophers. We're not suggesting public policy. Then after a while, people started looking at the logic of their thought and recognized, you know what? It's true. If we could kill you then, for those reasons, why can't we kill you now? And there are a lot of people now who are advancing these causes. So now, in Belgium, in 2015, in the Journal of Medical Ethics, same journal, they examined the deliberate euthanasia of patients in Belgium without their explicit voluntary consent as required by law. The author's study reports that life-ending drugs were used with the intention to shorten life and without explicit request in 1.7% of all deaths in Belgium in 2013. Not all deaths of people who were terminally ill, all deaths. And that was in 2013. Can you imagine what it's like now, 10 years later? In 52.7% of those cases, the patients were 80 years of age or older. The decision to euthanize was not discussed with the patient in 77.9% of the cases because he or she was comatose, had dementia, or because discussion would have been harmful to the patient's best interest. So we can kill you, but gosh, we don't want to talk to you about it because if we did, it might make you feel bad. So we'll just do it involuntarily. In Canada, they have the Medical Aid in Dying program. People are not terminal. They're going to extend it next year if minors are sufficiently mature. By the way, they're also going to extend it to people whose only problem in life is mental illness. Right? They aren't terminally ill, and they're going to put you to death. There are people who have life-threatening complications or issues, and there are treatments for them, but they're expensive. So they won't provide them with their socialized medicine treatment, but they will subsidize them for $1.50 medical suicide. Canada is swiftly becoming a death cult nation, and they are working overtime to infect us here. And by the way, folks, if you think, oh, this could never happen here, you have a complete ignorance of human history. There are the Germans. If you grew up on Hogan's Heroes, right, you thought the Germans were a bunch of idiots. They were not. They were unbelievably educated. They had tremendous architecture. They had the best continental universities in Europe. They were very literate people. How did they get to the point where they would gas 6 million Jews and kill 6 million other people? If it can happen there, it can happen here. If you are waiting for Nazis to come goose-stepping down Main Street, you are going to wait a long time. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell you that America makes the Nazis look like pikers. They had to put those people on trains, take them far away, gas them in places far away. We have so permeated our culture with this idea that we should kill children. We can build abortion clinics in the middle of residential neighborhoods, and we've talked our young people into driving the victims there themselves and paying for the privilege. That's the nation you currently, in many states right now, inhabit. In California, you can have an abortion through all 9 months of pregnancy for any reason whatsoever at taxpayer expense if the woman involved is a minor without parental knowledge or consent. Folks, evil always comes in different guises, but it always bears the same principles. Find the weakest, most defenseless image bearer of God. Dehumanize them, and then you can do anything you want to them, including killing them. Robin Marty, in her book, don't buy this book, by the way. Don't give her any money, but if you can find it in a used bookstore, buy it and read it. She will give you the blueprint for how they intend to flip your state into an abortion state. They're going to start with rape and incest. They're going to make you look like a monster. And once they get that once they get their nose under the tent, folks, if I can kill you because you were not properly conceived, it has nothing to do with what you are, just how you came to be. If that's a reason why I can kill you, why can't I have other reasons why I can kill you? That's why you need a bright line distinction. So what can you do? Authentic pro-life people do two things. They speak up and they rescue. I need you to use your voice, folks. If you don't do it, as we've already assessed tonight, no one else will. There should be 600 people in this room. There's not. I don't know, maybe 150 people in this room. Still a pretty good crowd. Pretty happy that you're here. But I need to let you understand it's up to us. Now, if you want to become a better pro-life speaker, I can help that happen. We've got a class coming up this coming summer at Cedarville University, and I'm going to teach it. You're going to give 20 presentations in a week. It's going to be very hard. You will come out a monster public speaker, which will be a good thing. I have the same program available online. If you're interested, just email me, and I'll send you the information about it. Continue to study. Always remember, there is a difference between being exposed to information and knowing information. Tonight, we've been exposed. Can't expect you to be able to reproduce this right now. I've got a book over there, though, that covers everything and a whole lot more of what we've talked about here tonight. And here's the best part. Every single one of you who registered for this class, and as long as you'll do it today, so before you go home, go to speakerforlife.com/events, find the Edmund Contenders class, the one you're in right now, and register for it. And then my assistant tomorrow is going to mail out packets of information to you, and you're going to want some of that information, but all of it is resident in that book over there. So what does that mean? You've got your outline, right? The blank outline. Now you can study, fill it out, and guess what? You still have a blank outline. It's in your computer. You can take my name off the front, you can put your name on the front, and you can take this information, chunk it out, don't try to do 3 hours, chunk it out, and teach it to your youth group, your college career class, your small group, your Sunday school class. If you go to college, find a group of people, sit down and go through it together. Say, hey, look, we're going to evaluate pro-choice claims. You can even, you know, strategically use their term if you'd like. And then walk people through it. And this is how. Folks, if you try to do it online, tech titans are going to throttle you back. But if you do it analog, nobody's going to get in your way. Sit down and teach the material. And then rescue. Linda's here tonight. Linda, what is the name? Give me your URL.
Friendsofcrossroads.org.
Please write that.
Yeah,
please don't do that. Friendsofcrossroads.org. And you can go there, and there is a place for you to be able to donate online. You need to understand something. Linda over here and her staff, They are literally standing in the gap to save the lives of unborn children being threatened by abortion right here in Oklahoma. And if you don't think there are children being threatened by abortion here in pro-life Oklahoma, you've not been paying attention to how easy it is to get people across to a state where they can have a legal abortion, or Robin Marty's people who are willing to mail them abortion pills. And then new news articles pop up that show that abortion pills, you can abort a 20-week-old gestated fetus. Somebody just did it in Nebraska. They got arrested, thrown in jail. They aborted that child with pills at 24 weeks, burned the body and buried it. Why'd that article appear? To tell people, hey, guess what? You can even abort these children even farther along. That's what these folks are dealing with every single day. I know you can't all volunteer at a pregnancy center, but you can work for the pregnancy center by using that thing that is a wonderful transfer property of work. It's called money. Money. All money is portable work. And so you sponsor Linda and her organization, and you're going to see lives of unborn children are going to be saved. Linda, how many people came to know Christ through your organization last year?
We shared the gospel almost 400 times, and 119 men and women made professions of faith.
Did you hear that? 119 people made professions of faith. Some of you are from churches that are smaller than that. And that was 1 year. Now, guess what? All those young women, they need to have a place to go. And so I want you to be thinking very seriously about, and I don't know if you have one here or not, Pastor Paul, but we need an embrace grace program at your church. It'd be great if they were at a number of different churches, depending on what kind of flavor these young girls grow into theologically. But Embrace Grace is a bridge program. We lead them to Jesus, we walk them through, and then they get folded into the life of your church. What an amazing thing. She comes in, she has her baby. She grows in grace and mercy. She becomes in stature a believer. If it's conformed to the image of Christ, a young man at your church falls in love with her. They get married. They have 1, 2, 3 other kids. And now they get up maybe one day on Mother's Day and share their story. What a redemptive moment that would be. How'd you like to have that at your church? You can get an Embrace Grace program. Use your voice to advocate, sponsor debates, campaign and vote. Be a church liaison between our organization and your area church. Don't be afraid of Facebook debates. Matter of fact, I've done it so many times, I actually have all my basic pro-life case written as a little, a Word document, and I just clip it and paste it. That way I don't have to keep rewriting it every single time. And I load it up with all kinds of evidence and everything else, and an amazing thing happens when you confront people with a lot of evidence. They go away, right? But this is the important part. You aren't debating them. You are debating them for the people who are reading that exchange. And you can still convince those people. Pray. You are given an incredible opportunity to actually stand in the throne room of Almighty God and put your petitions before Him. And I think a lot of times we greatly underestimate the power of that. Does it always change God's mind? No, but it'll always change you. So pray. And then finally, like I said, give. Go to friendsofcrossroads.org, and they've got a way for you to give online. By the way, I'd love it if some of you guys are really well healed. We've got all kinds of capital projects that need heavy funding. But folks, there's not a person in this room, not one of you, who can't sponsor this organization for $10 or $20 or $50 a month. I was just in Memphis, and a guy ponied up a grand, and a couple other people, I think, ponied up $150 a month in support. By the way, if you ever come to a banquet that I'm speaking at, you will never hear me ask you for $10, because if you've come to a banquet, you've been vetted, and I know you've got dough. And we want it, right? So, but here's the deal. God has given you all gifts, and I just want you to use them. Why? Because we are supposed to stand in the gap for the lives of our unborn neighbors. That's what loving our neighbors are all about. Last thing I'm going to tell you about, and then we're going to pray, and I'm going to stay until you guys kick me out. I'll answer all the questions you guys possibly have. We do need your help, as it says at the end of your notes. When you're done here tonight, and no later than tomorrow night, because if you wait longer than that, I'm telling you right now, you're never going to do this. I need you to email me with your overall impression of what you've learned here this evening. And then if you can think of, gosh, if somebody would have said X to me, that's what would have brought me out here. You say that, and if it's really good, we'll put it in promotional materials to get more and more people to come out. The subject line is Contenders, Edmund, Feedback. And then send it to mytake@speakerforlife.com. And then if we want to contact you later, make sure your information is there so that we can. So let's pray, and then I'm going to answer any questions you guys have. Like I said, the books are over there. They're $18.99. That's what they are at Amazon, except for here, delivery instant. right? So that's the benefit. We take cash, credit cards, checks, make them out to Speaker for Life. That'd be awesome. Let's pray. Father in heaven, thank you so much for this evening. Thank you for the patience of these people as they went a little over tonight. But I pray, Father, that you will take everything that was said tonight that is true and embed it deeply into our hearts. Most importantly, Father, I pray that you will give us a heart of compassion for the lives of our unborn neighbors. Our nation wants to act like they don't exist, but they do. You have them in sight. Father, give us the courage it takes to buck a culture of death and bring to it a culture of life. And in doing so, Father, make us the kind of people that as we push the gospel of life forward, not only physical life, but the spiritual life, that those who are able, those who have ears to hear, those who are willing will see it, desire it, want it, and be drawn out of a kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. Father, you've told us that you take no delight in the death of the wicked. Please do not allow us to glory in the demise of our enemies. Instead, Father, help us to have the heart of compassion that you had for us while we were sinners and estranged from you, and extend it to other people, always being willing to be brave, tell the truth, suffer persecution if necessary. Help us to be courageous. But Father, also help us to be merciful and loving, forgiving and gracious, just as you have been to us. We ask you for all of these things. Please get us all home safely tonight. And just be with us and encourage us, Father, to act on what we have learned. We ask these things in the name of your precious Son, Jesus. Amen.